Welcome to Clay and Iron with Dr. Bill Deagle, MD. That's me. And our special guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. And sometimes I start off with the news for the hour. I just wanted to make some comments about Professor Yanka at the University of Texas A&M. Again, the interesting comments that were made on today's program, the Alex Jones show, the InfoWars on the Genesis Network. My show, of course, is on right after that on Monday, Tuesdays, and Thursdays, called the Nutramedical Report. And you can listen on GCN Live. That's GCNLIVE.com. Dr. Pianca has been a tenured professor for 38 years, and of course, he is not an outlier or an exception. He is actually the standard, which is that they do want to rapidly reduce the world population. They want to use violent, military, or other means necessary. This follows Agenda 21, and also follows the plans for the United Nations to use bioweapons, deplete uranium, whatever it takes. But none of this is really necessary, because in all Western cultures, the population drops to a reproductive rate of about 1.6, and the population should peak about 8.7 billion and then start dropping very precipitously after that, especially because we're polluting the planet. And not because the population is too much, but because the people at the top want to spread depleted uranium, want lots of toxins and genetically modified food, which dramatically reduces fertility. So none of this is necessary. So just some interesting comments. Want you to check that out yourself. As I always say on my other show, the Nutramedical Report, you want to check it out yourself, own the truth, and then take action. And I would take it one step further on Clay and Iron, which is if you don't love the truth, you will not master it, and therefore you will be a victim of it. So welcome to the program, Stanton Friedman.
Glad to be on.
Well, for those who don't know Stanton, he is the one of the world experts on the issue of flying saucers, UFOs, and of course everybody that doesn't believe this will have their antenna go up and say, oh, well, that's it. I don't want to hear anymore. But I can tell you as a physician who's worked on a lot of classified projects, I was sort of shoved into this laterally by being exposed to lots of senior high clearance level agents, people who worked in deep underground bases, people that worked on the U.S. Star Wars SDI projects. And from so many sources, it was just incontrovertible from the Skunk Works and from my knowledge of things that went on from Nazi Germany onward, I realized that this was very real. And this was not an imaginary thing. I dealt with, I was a civil aviation examiner for many years, taking care of pilots, both military and non-military. And this is a standard fare. So welcome to the program, Stanton. And you've done so many lectures, you can kind of capsulize why do the powers that be in the media not want us to know all of this very vital information?
Well, it's a combination. We got a triumvirate here. We have the government powers, the people really in power. We have the media guys, and we have the scientific community, the ancient academics and fossilized physicists, as I call them. I mean, I'm a nuclear physicist. I worked for little companies like General Electric, General Motors, Westinghouse, McDonnell Douglas, TRW Systems, Aerojet General Nucleonics. You know, the places I work don't exist anymore, but that's right.
Right.
But I come at this from a peculiar viewpoint, especially the whole UFO scene. I've never seen a UFO. But like you, because I had a security clearance for 14 years,
right,
and because I lecture so widely on the subject flying saucers are real, more than 700 colleges and professional groups in all 50 states, 9 provinces, and 14, 16 other countries, I get a chance to talk to lots and lots of people who feel safe talking to me because they know, A, I'm not going to laugh, B, I respect security in the sense that I know how it works. And,
right,
you know, the reasons, I once gave a paper in which I listed 26 reasons for coming to planet Earth, and the eyebrows go up, and then people start laughing, because, you know, why do people travel? Why do beings travel? I mean, I don't think we're the crown of creation, the most developed civilization in our local neighborhood. I
yes.
think we're the equivalent of the gorillas in a nature preserve in Africa who have no idea what's going on outside the preserve.
Absolutely, and go on.
Well, let me give you my reasons that I think the government, you know, why hasn't the truth come out? Aside from laziness and all that sort of thing, because it takes work to get at the truth. You can't just pull things out of the air. First, you want to figure out how the darn things work. They make wonderful weapons delivery and defense systems. That's where the action is. I worked on big programs. Well, as an example, when I was working on nuclear airplanes for General Electric way back in 1958, just a stripling of a lad, you know, our budget at General Electric was $100 million a year, and a dollar was really worth a buck back then.
Wow, that's a lot of money. You're talking about probably at least 10 or 20 times the value of that.
Well, it's big, and there were 3,500 people employed full-time, and 1,100 of them were engineers and scientists. So we're not talking about a project with four professors and 12 grad students or something. We're talking about a big project. But the data was classified. It wasn't a black program. That is, the sign on the door said General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department. But that relates to another crazy thing I bring to this subject, having to do with technology. I've worked on far-out propulsion systems, nuclear airplanes, fission nuclear rockets, fusion nuclear rockets, nuclear power plants for space. So I can deal with the stupid argument that you can't get here from there, which is a nonsensical argument. Nuclear fusion, which every astronomer in the world knows what it is, because that's what makes the stars work. If you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end, having 10 million times as much energy per particle as you can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. So Friedman's Law, it's not in the law books yet, but what the heck. Technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. A laser isn't just a better light bulb, in other words. So the first reason for cover-up is you want to figure out how the darn things work. And you've got wreckage from Roswell. I'm the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident, dating back to the 70s, for goodness sakes. They can read my book, Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident. It says right on the cover, you know, if you can't believe the cover, what can you believe? You've got wreckage. You set up your secret project. Rule number one for security, as you know, is you can't tell your friends without telling your enemies.
Right.
People say, well, why don't they tell us? Well, you know, our enemies read the newspapers, listen to the radio, etc. The second problem is the other side of the very same coin. What if the other guys in every country has an other guy, you know, India and Pakistan, the Israelis and the Arabs, etc., us and the Russians for a long time, China and everybody else at the moment, I suppose. What if the other guy figures out how they work before you do? We do. You don't want them to know, we know, they know. You know,
right.
Weapon, counter-weapon, counter-counter-weapon, bigger spears, stronger shields. You know, the game's been going on for
right, it goes back to the first rock and the first stick.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we're each trying to negate the other guys and do our best to get ours better. The third problem is different. It's a political problem. Suppose an announcement were to be made tomorrow by, well, let's say two highly trusted individuals around the world. A little hard to find, but let's say the Queen and the Pope. You know, you pick
people,
your odd couple.
Most people would believe if they said something.
Yeah. What if they said, indeed, some UFOs are alien spacecraft? What would happen? Well, church attendance would go up. Mental hospital admissions would go up. The stock market would go down because uncertainty is the enemy, you know, of the stock market. But I think, based on more than 600 college lectures, that the younger generation, which, unlike me, was never alive and there wasn't a space program. You can't believe how anti-space the astronomical community was back in the 30s, 40s, 50s. If the younger generation would say, look, these guys would lead us to believe, anybody studying the data would say, hey, we're all Earthlings. We got something in common. And the problem with that, which at first you say, gee, that's great, and then you point out to people, hey, I don't know any government on this planet that wants its citizens to owe their allegiance to the planet instead of that individual government. Nationalism's the only game in town. And you look around the planet, everybody wants his own country so he can have power. Power is what we're talking about here. And so I don't know anybody who would push us in that direction. I mean, we say we're a democracy, but can you believe that we would be willing to have an election in the world about who speaks for planet Earth to negotiate with aliens? The Chinese would say, yeah, yeah, we got four times as many people as you guys do.
Right.
The United States ain't going to go for that. Now,
especially if you're going to negotiate things, because, of course, as soon as you start talking to, let's say, an off-world civilization, you're always involved with trade and negotiation,
yeah,
transferring technology, et cetera.
Yeah, And, you know, some people...
And whoever has the technology rules.
That's right. That's right. And we're sort of losing the way. If you look at the space situation, we're not being number one anymore. I read something like 60% of the boosters being launched into space are not American, even though at one point more than half were American. You know, so we're not ruling the roost as much as we'd like to think. Now, there's a fourth problem. I'll call it a religious problem. For certain fundamentalists, and fundamentalism is a problem not just in the Middle East, we have Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, who have loudly proclaimed publicly that there are no aliens. We are the only intelligent life in the universe. This stuff is all the work of the devil. They've said that publicly.
Yeah, no, it's really disturbing, isn't it?
Yeah, and they'd be up the creek without a paddle if somebody said aliens are coming here. Well,
and the other thing is what they say doesn't even get supported by the Bible itself.
Well, that's right. And, you know, there are religions.
That's really bizarre. I mean, it's the exact opposite of what the Bible itself says in these ancient documents from other religions.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre. It's like, okay, they got whatever they're teaching, but it doesn't even fit with the documents that they supposedly espouse it on.
Yeah, and, you know, people who are interested in this want to look at a book by Dr. Barry Downing, The Bible in Flying Saucers, who goes into both the Old and New Testaments and finds examples of what we would call UFO sightings.
Right.
The fourth problem is different. I'll call it economics. If an announcement were to be made, obviously not quietly, but carefully, not war of the worlds. I mean, heck, I was living in New Jersey when the Wells' broadcast was made, and I didn't hear the program, I must admit. But if you lived in New Jersey then and you believed the program, you had a right to panic, for goodness sakes. What are we going to do against Martians? You know, we hadn't been in space or even close to it at the time. But if you make the announcement carefully, a lot of people are going to say, and I've had people say this, look, they must be more advanced than we are because they're coming here and we're not going there. That means that soon there may be new methods of energy production. Whoops, there goes the oil industry. New methods of ground and air transport. There go autos and planes. New methods of computers and communication systems. And that hits the rest of the big guys.
Right.
Utter economic chaos. And
yeah, so all of the big players in terms of the world economy are completely turned on their head.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
and
is why,
you know,
things like, of course, Tesla's Pierce Arrow car and all the other technologies for producing food and everything else, it's like Buckminster Fuller said, there's no such thing as shortage. It's created by the power elite that want to create shortage to create a situation of power.
Make stuff more valuable.
Right.
You know, if you legalized all the drugs in the world, those guys would go out of business, wouldn't they?
Right.
Because there'd be no profit. It doesn't cost much to make them. But the parallel in recent history, if you go back in the late 80s, remember when we said if only the Russians would have freedom and elections and democracy and capitalism, everything would be great. And they've had all those things, and everything's terrible. The average Russian is, as I understand it, not really any better off than he was back then. We're not good as large.
There's a few rich Russian oligarch leaders, and otherwise they're poorer than ever.
Yeah. So then there's a sixth reason. This is quite different. In the course of my lecturing, because a lot of people are willing to talk to me, they know I'm not going to laugh, and they know I don't use names without permission and all the rest of that. I have now heard seven different stories of more planes, American planes, going up after UFOs than came back down. And I've been working with a guy named Frank Fascino, Jr. Who,
you mean they go up, but the planes don't come back down after?
Well, three go up and two come down.
Right.
And what happens to the other one? And Frank Fascino, who is the expert on the Flatwoods, West Virginia case of September 12, 1952.
Right.
I wrote the foreword and epilogue for his book, The Braxton County Monster, Cover-Up of the Flatwoods Monster Revealed. There's a new edition that will be coming out this year, I believe. Anyway, in the course of the book being publicized, some people said, hey, you make it sound like there were dogfights between pilots, military pilots, Americans, and UFOs. That didn't happen. Well, we went out and looked hard, and you know what? What we found was there were many cases of, I'll call it a dogfight, for want of a better phrase. We also found clear proof that military pilots in the summer of 52, which everybody knows was a big year for UFO sightings over Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, They were ordered to shoot down UFOs if they didn't land when instructed to do so.
Oh.
Now, cartoonists would have a field day with that.
Right.
But here's the kicker. General Roger Ramey, who was also involved in the Roswell incident when he was only a brigadier general in 1947, in 52, he's quoted, not in the New York Times or Washington Post, interestingly enough, but in other newspapers, as saying, "We have scrambled jets hundreds of times after UFOs." Hundreds. He didn't say a few, several, hundreds of times. Now, if you look more deeply, you find that there were loads of crashes of military planes in 52. And not only crashes, but I'd love the words they use, disintegrations and disappearances. For example, three pilots separately had done over 100 missions in Korea, you know, with MiGs chasing them and all the rest of that. So the guy's got to be a pretty good pilot to survive that, presumably. Three different pilots with 100 missions in Korea came back to the United States and crashed. That seems highly strange, you know, because there weren't any MiGs over here chasing them. And so I don't think any government wants to admit that, oh, by the way, we lost a lot of planes and pilots because we instructed them to shoot down UFOs, and apparently the UFOs didn't like it. And so you can understand that they'd be reluctant. Now, admittedly, some people are going to say, hey, wait a minute, wait, you're kidding. That all these... I mean, if I heard of seven cases, and there's got to be a lot more than that, these guys disappeared, they were splattered, whatever, and nobody knows about it? Well, let me give an example of how you keep secrets. In 2001, the U.S. government had a big conference in Washington where they had the families of 166 military guys who were in reconnaissance planes that were shot down by the Russians or Chinese or Koreans near either one of those three countries. This is back in the late 40s, early 50s,
right,
before satellites. So we were doing reconnaissance. We'd get as close as we could to the coast. And sometimes we went over the boundary, you know. In 2001, their families were finally told what had happened to their sons or brothers or husbands or whatever. They were given medals. Thanks a lot, guys. You know, never knew what happened to their families.
That's a lot of years later.
That secret, you know, that's a lot of people we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so there is precedent for major secrets being kept for a very long time. And, you know, that's one of the crazy arguments against UFOs or even against Roswell.
Oh, yes.
Despite all the enormous evidence, people say, oh, they couldn't keep it secret that long.
Oh, yes, they could.
Well, let me pop a couple of examples on people. I say pop for a reason. The National Reconnaissance Organization, which is bigger than the CIA, it's the spy master of space, they admitted at the tail end of 2005, not very long ago, that between 1962 and 1971, they had launched seven Poppy satellites, P-O-P-P-Y. I don't know where the name came from, but these were to spy on Russian ships at sea. First public word was 2005. Now, the business end of the NRO satellites are very expensive, very sophisticated. You know, $500 million is not unusual for one of their satellite payloads because they got to get information, last a long time, send information back. So it took until 2005 to admit what happened between 62 and 71. There's one example. The Naval Research Lab, in a commemorative booklet, their 75th anniversary in 1995, stated that they had made a major contribution to national security by launching a whole series of Corona satellites. Now, these were electronic intelligence satellites going over the Soviet Union, among other places, and the whole world for that matter. And the first one that worked was the 13th in the series. The other 12 failed. Not one word about what these really were. It was just a scientific satellite, an unfortunate accident, too bad. The first one that was successful in 1960, mind you, we first hear about it in 1995, got more information about Soviet electronics, you know, radar systems, communication systems, all that sort of stuff, than all the U-2 flights which preceded it.
Amazing, isn't it?
Not one word until 1995. And I'll guarantee you there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people involved in those. And one other of a different sort. During World War II, we had broken the German code, the Enigma code, you know?
Right.
And there were 12,000 people, we meaning the Allies, mostly the English guys. There were 12,000 people at Bletchley Park in England who were intercepting and decoding and providing to selected military people information about what the Germans were transmitting. We had their orders as quickly as Hitler did.
Yes.
Not one word for 25 years. 12,000 people, and you know darn well the codes got changed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and what's remarkable is they were able to keep it quiet while they kept the Admiralty in the dark in Pearl Harbor and created the Pearl Harbor situation because they kept the code from them. And again, no leaks at all.
The thing is that security works. And,
right.
You know, in 1996, the director of Central Intelligence admitted that his black budget for the year, there was a legal suit, otherwise he wouldn't have admitted it. There was a legal suit. His black budget that year was only $26.6 billion. Billion. Now, estimates for what it is now, and all we have is estimates because they won't release the numbers, are $40 billion or so a year. Now, those are big amounts of money. At least they are to me.
Yeah.
So who knows what's going on all over the place that we don't know anything about?
Well, and of course, that's the public budget. There's lots of, private funds coming in from global organizations.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, the laundering of the drugs that come into America generate extra $250 billion a year that goes into all kinds of very strange projects.
Yeah. Well, the point is that the notion that you can't cover up what we know about UFOs is nonsense. And after my lectures, I go through a little sequence. The lecture is entitled Flying Saucers Are, underlined and capitalized, real, exclamation point. I'm not an apologist ufologist.
Right.
Or a closet ufologist. After my lectures, before anybody gets a chance to ask a question, I ask my audience a question. I say, how many people here believe they've seen what I would consider to be a flying saucer? And I've given a definition early on in the lecture. Now, they know I'm not going to laugh. And I just ask them to raise their hands. I make a joke. You know, we didn't let the CIA in today and so forth. The hands go up hesitantly at first. But because I'm on the stage, I can point and say, 1, 2, 3, 4, start counting. By the time I get to the other side of the room, the hands go up much more vigorously. Typically, it's 10%, which is a lot of people.
Right.
And then I ask, how many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down. Now, then I ask, if there's anybody left, I'll ask a question. How many of you were in the military at the time?
Mm-hmm.
And if there's still somebody left, because people have gotten now in the habit of being honest, they know they're not the only one who's seen one or reported it and so forth, you want to tell us about it. And then I get some great stories. Some great lines. One guy in front of 1,300 people at a university in Texas says, I asked you want to tell us about it. And he says, I can't. They told me not to say anything, which was a wonderful line.
Right.
But many of these guys will approach me privately, and I get some great stories. Now, no, they don't hand me classified documents, and I certainly don't offer people money for transmitting classified information. It's against the law.
Right.
You know, that's treason, I think they call it, or something like that. But I get enough stories independently. I never use these in my life.
Well, we're back on the air. This is Dr. Bill Deagle, MD, and we're now talking on Clay and Iron with Stanton Friedman. And, of course, that little interruption there was probably not a technical glitch, according to Don Newsom of BBS Radio. It was probably another little interference by one of the above government organizations that don't really want us to carry on this dialogue because it's being – I love the way you're dealing with this, Stanton. You're not coming at it from a how can I say it? An ad hominem attack or
charismatic hand waving?
Exactly. You're dealing with it with a very systematic, like teasing it apart like an autopsy. And you're dealing with it very similar to what Martin Sheen did when he asked a lot of really good questions with Alex Jones. And that's why his argument was so persuasive, is that he didn't even make any conclusions. He just asked the series, just like sophistry, of really good questions and said, you know, on the basis of this question, what seems the most obvious, simple, straightforward response that you'd make to this? And the way you conducted your question line in the audience obviously starts to peel back the facade and the a priori ideas and all the fear among the audience so that they can start coming out and talking about these things. And
that's right. And, you know, one of the things people say, how can you keep going? I've been lecturing for 39 years.
Right.
Even I'm impressed. But because of the enthusiastic response of the audiences, and because it's become clear from the comments made to me by attendees. For example, 2 weeks ago, I spoke in Colorado Springs, Colorado, at Pikes Peak Community College. Now,
right. For
people who don't know, Colorado Springs is the home of Cheyenne Mountain, you know, the Air Defense Command, Peterson Air Force Base, Fort Carson. It's loaded with military people all over the place.
In fact, that's where I worked and got my feet wet, if you want to call it, in these super classified projects, as their doctor, and had it sort of shoved in my face that this stuff was real.
Well, I can believe that, but what was funny to me, in the first place, the first time Pikes Peak Community College had ever filled their auditorium, not only did they fill it, but we had to give a second lecture. That's a rare event, and I got home back to the hotel awful late. But there were military people there. I was selling copies of my books and autographing things and stuff. People like to, you know, get up close and personal kind of thing.
Right.
And there were military guys, let's put it this way, who quietly said nice things like, keep up the work and you're right on and stuff like that.
Oh, now, yeah, all of the Air Force guys that I took care of, because I took care of military and civilian pilots, they have hundreds of stories like this over all the years. They just, you know, would keep it on the QT, and they would glad somebody else other than them, because they would probably get court-martialed.
Yeah.
Or be considered classified information, or they were told, you know, they're taking all these oaths and so on. So they wouldn't release it. And I, of course, wouldn't release their names, but I can tell you, these stories are so consistent and happen so often that it was crazy. And I've also seen or taken care of astronauts as well, so I know what's going on. And these stories are not...
And you get these stories independently, too.
Right. They're independent, and they're very consistent, and you hear the same kinds of stories repeatedly from many different sources, and you put it together and you say, you know, this is real.
Yeah, and so I take heart from all of that stuff. I find it very, it's not just ego-pleasing, but it's satisfying. People ask me these why questions, not only why the cover-up and, you know, why would aliens come here and stuff
right.
like that, but they ask other questions, because that's what really intrigues me.
Well, that should be the start of a whole sort of new questions, like, are there, quote, good, and are there ones with evil intentions, and how sophisticated are they in terms of manipulating us? Because if we're like the, if you want to call it a very remote game park in the galaxy, then obviously they're going to be pretty sophisticated, and they're going to have means of communication and dialogue and negotiations that probably is well beyond the average range of the average person in our society, even the fairly advanced government.
Well, look at what a short history we have. I mean, on the one hand, I have to say, for all I know, there have been 20 different civilizations here over the past billion years about which we know nothing.
Well, we probably had, I trained in advanced chemistry and marine bacteriology and genetics before I went into medicine, and my chemistry professor traveled to Ashurbanipal, India, and proved, and he was no religious expert, he proved that there was a radionuclides that were caused by a nuclear explosion around 12,900 years ago that covered an area of at least 12,600 square miles.
Well,
and
that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, and so we know that there were advanced technologies here on the Earth, that there were major cataclysms, probably conflicts between these various warring civilizations that were very ancient.
And or idiots like ourselves who
right,
are destroying each other.
Right, and we're the prelude to another sticks and stones age where people will crawl out of the caves again, because I'm certain that this has happened before, that the Earth is, quote, formless and void.
Well, let me give an example. Henrik Schliemann discovered Troy. Now, he was a rich amateur archaeologist, and way back about 1875, I think it was, he had used the Iliad and the Odyssey as sort of textbooks and figured out where Troy ought to be. And because he was rich, he could afford to pay people to dig down 75 feet. And, of course, he'd been told by the historians, if Troy really existed, we historians would know all about it.
Right.
Well, he dug down 75 feet, and he found Troy. Now, that's only from a few thousand years ago. Now, how much of the planet have we explored down 75 feet? Darn little! And what if we're talking 50,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago?
Or even longer.
Well, yeah, we got a cool billion years to play with. And I picked the number billion because one of my favorite places for the origin of some UFOs is a planet around either one of two stars, Zeta 1 Reticuli or Zeta 2 Reticuli. It's the Greek letter Zeta, and it's the constellation of Reticulum. You can't see it from here. You've got to go below the equator. Now, what's special about them, besides the fact that our knowledge about them came out of the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case, New Hampshire, 1961, when Betty saw a star map and a brilliant woman built three-dimensional models and was able to identify the stars in the map and so forth. But what's special about them is what's intriguing to me. Here we have two sun-like stars. Now, not too hot, not too cold, not too warm.
In other words, they're a similar yellow dwarf type of star system.
Well, yeah, similar to the sun. Now, within 54 light years of here, which is just down the street, I mean, don't tell me about other galaxies. I don't care about other galaxies.
Right.
You know, within 54 light years, there's 1,000 stars, roughly. And of those, 46 are similar to the sun and might be expected to have planets in life, 5%. Okay, here we have two of these stars that are unique. They're the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our whole local neighborhood. How close are they? Well, the sun from the next star over is about 4.5 light years away, and the next sun-like star is about 11 light years away. But Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, which are only 39 light years from here, which is just down the street on a cosmic scale. I mean, the galaxy is 80,000 light years across or so. Next big galaxy over is 1,000,000 light years. You can see how I don't worry about the next galaxy.
Right.
But these two stars are only an eighth of a light year apart, which means they're 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over, of any kind over.
Right.
And that means that from a planet around one, you can see the other star all day long. You could directly observe, no guessing, planets around the other star. And that means that you'd have far more incentive for interstellar travel if you got a guy next door instead of, you know, across the ocean. But what's really intriguing is those two stars are about 1,000,000,000 years older than the sun. Now, you would expect that they would have some knowledge that we don't have. At least I would expect that.
Right.
And so, you know, if you've got a place just down the street, you'd expect that to be sort of the center of the Galactic Federation, if you will.
Right.
They'd reach out to each other. Even if there's only a civilization on one planet around one of them, pretty soon it's going to colonize the other because it's there.
In a relatively short period of time.
Yeah. And then you start moving out and looking around. And I find that terribly exciting. And so when I hear the SETI boys, and you know how I feel about SETI, S-E-T-I, it really stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, as opposed to Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Right.
They're not looking for intelligence. If they were, they'd be looking at the UFO data where the intelligence is coming here. But you see, if aliens are visiting Earth, who needs a radio telescope?
Yeah, it's all a matter of, it's like anything, it's business. It's like the big drug companies want to sell drugs, so they don't want you to know that if you take a cholesterol-lowering drug, you should take Quinton Q10 to not get heart failure.
Well, there are a lot of business. Things they don't want you to know.
Right,
like get enough
thing.
Magnesium and things like that.
Right, it's simple. And, you know, if you're selling radio telescopes or want to have an astronomy program, you certainly don't want to be looking, you know, so many light years away when there's debris or there's technical people that have actually seen these or there are even government agencies that are working with them.
When you have wreckage and you have bodies. And
right.
We have Ted Phillips in Missouri. Ted, for more than 35 years, has been collecting reports where the saucer is seen on or near the ground, not a light in the sky, but a definite three-dimensional object sitting on or near the ground. 16% of the more than 5,000 cases he's collected from 70 countries. When you have that many physical trace cases, and they're dull after you read the first 200.
Yeah, they become
you know, routine.
So
they're seen all over the place. The beings are seen with them, and these are almost always the little guys, the little craft.
Right.
But we have, I get a kick out of people who say, well, you know, look how long it takes to get here. They couldn't have gotten here for Roswell because they didn't pick up our television signals by then. And I say, wait a minute, why do you think that each craft that is here just came from home?
Right.
It hangs around for a while, does its graduate student thesis work, and then goes back home. My longest lecture tour was 25 lectures in 35 days in 15 states. And you know what? I wasn't home from the time I left until the end of the whole tour. I didn't go out back. I went from A to B to C to D and finally went home at the end of all that. Now, I'm a little older now. I probably couldn't do that anymore. But the false notion that they wouldn't know we were here until they picked up a signal. Now, we all know that Columbus didn't set off toward the New World until the Indians sent him smoke signals, right?
I mean, yeah, right.
How absurd can you get? And I love the argument that it's so much cheaper to send a signal. You know, I've been to Australia a couple of times. The plane was jammed from L.A. to Australia, even though it would be a lot cheaper to make a call or to use the Internet. But people travel for a variety of reasons. People want one reason. Why would aliens come here? Well, graduate students doing their thesis research on the development of a primitive society isn't such a bad idea. Or broadcasters with a weekly show, idiocy in the boondocks.
Right.
Or mining engineers. People forget that the Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. I don't mean the people. That's probably true, too. But
a cubic
foot of Earth weighs more than a cubic foot of any other planet.
Right.
Saturn is so light you could float it on a big enough bucket of water if you had one.
Right.
Now, who cares, you might say, and then you realize that, wait a minute now, heavy metals are in rare supply in the universe. We know from studying the spectrum of stars that we can see all over the place. Now, I'm not talking about lead, which isn't very heavy. I'm talking about rhenium, osmium, platinum, gold, uranium, tungsten, where rhenium's twice the density, osmium's twice the density of lead. And all of these metals have very special properties, some of them very high melting points, some of them special nuclear properties, etc. And we also, in our solar system, we got a whole bunch of asteroids flying around. And you might say, who cares, except that you don't want to get hit by one. But asteroids are loaded with minerals.
Yeah, they're great. If you could hitch one of these and grab it and mine it, you could literally mine out all kinds. And
yeah, you don't need to dig a ton of stuff out of the ground.
Right.
Grab yourself an asteroid. Beat it up, grab it, and refine it, et cetera.
And, of course, there's all kinds of other materials like helium-3 and so on. And
biological materials?
Sure.
Look at the value of, say, vitamin B12 per pound.
Right.
It's worth a fortune. But what I'm trying to say here is you need a different kind of perspective about what's going on. And the SETI guys, what I don't understand is the bad science. Now, they'll all make pronouncements, proclamations from on high that there isn't any good evidence. Now, I've seen that, and then you read their books, and I do read theirs. They don't read mine.
Right.
Seth Shostak and I each gave 3 lectures on the Queen Elizabeth II on its last westward voyage in 2004. We attended each other's lecture. And I always ask, I talk about 5 large-scale scientific studies at the beginning of my lecture, and I'm sneaky. I ask, how many of you have read this? I show a slide of the cover and tell what's in it and stuff. He didn't raise his hand for any. Now, we did a 3-hour debate on coast-to-coast radio, and it was as if it went in one ear and out the other. Like, none of those studies exist. You read their books, there are no references to any of the large-scale studies.
Right.
So if you put, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, the rest of it, you close your eyes and your ears, you can say there is no compelling evidence. But then they even get sneakier, which really bugs me. On the horrible Peter Jennings show.
Yeah, that was very sham, wasn't it?
Yeah, I really was unhappy about that. But February 24th, 2005, we have one of these PhD astronomers telling us that, look, our fastest craft, the Voyager spacecraft, would take 70,000 years to get to the next nearest star, and most scientists like to be around when their experiments are finished. He didn't bother to add a couple of facts. One, there is no propulsion system on the darn thing. It's coasting. You know, throw a bottle in the ocean, that's going to tell you how long it takes to cross the ocean. You know, that's one thing. Secondly, he didn't bother to mention that, hey, with fusion and fission, we know of things that'll get us there a heck of a lot faster.
And that's even with conventional space travel, whereas non-conventional travel in the future will fold space-time and allow the craft to jump across huge distances, folding the fifth dimension.
Well, you know, the track record of astronomers about advanced propulsion systems, let me give you 3 quick examples. One, Simon Newcomb, one of the great astronomers of the 19th century. in October 1903, published a scientific paper in which he showed that the only way man would ever fly would be with the help of a balloon. That was 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight.
Amazing, isn't it?
And when he was informed of that, well, maybe a pilot, but they're certainly never carrying any passengers. When one of his colleagues, Dr. Bickerton, in the 20s, proved, scientifically, of course, that there was no way you could give anything sufficient energy to get it into orbit around the Earth. We know how right he was, but my favorite was a Canadian, Dr. Campbell, 1941. There was a lot of science fiction then, you may not be old enough, but the pulp magazines and stuff, about going to the moon, you know. And he said, oh, this is a crack of baloney. So he published a scientific paper in which he set out to calculate the required initial launch weight of a rocket, just a dumb old chemical rocket, able to get a man to the moon and back. Now, that's a legitimate question. How big is the darn thing?
How big does the rocket have to be in order to get off the Earth? Yeah.
But to get to the moon and back.
Yeah.
Well, pages of equations. Bottom line, it would have to weigh a million tons. Now, even for me, that's too big. But you realize, in 1969, we got three guys to the moon and back, still with a dumb old chemical rocket, whose initial launch weight was 3,000 tons. He was off by a factor of 300 million. When these guys do calculations about space travel, they're almost invariably astronomically in error because it's something about which they know nothing.
Right. You know, I find it funny. It's like statistics. They try to calculate out, just like they'll take calculations of both stars. And if you think about it, it's a philosophical problem. The really good scientists, the real good journalists, have a love of the truth, both the beauty and the ugliness of it, but they know that if they don't master it, then they're going to be a victim of it. And that's what I want people to seek, listening to this program. I just want them to start evaluating things. And I also want them to then go from this point, okay, now that they've reached the point that these things are real, then let us find out, what is the next step? Like, for example, if you look at our current geopolitics and what we're doing with uranium and everything else, we're soiling our cage. We're destroying the planet, and there's no need for it because we could have Tesla-type energy systems. We could have renewable resources. We do not need to worry about the population going through the ceiling because it won't. It just won't. I mean,
it never has when we've had a civilization develop some technology.
Once the civilization develops, like Germany and so on, the population, if anything, implodes. And, you know, in fact, if we don't solve a lot of these problems, the very genetic changes caused by the pollution and the lack of fertility, we're going to have a population implosion. We'll be dealing with a population of maybe, you know, 5 or 10 million in 100 years, even without wars.
Won't even be around. Let me give my website so people
absolutely,
know. Because I got a lot of articles on there that they might find interesting besides my books and videos and all this stuff and some challenges to the SETI specialists and to the Air Force. It's very simple, www.stanton, S-T-A-N-T-O-N, Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, .com.
Right, that's stantonfriedman.com.
Yeah. And
of course, I've got a couple questions. Now that liberals say a priori we're going to jump to the conclusion all of this is real, the first thing that I would ask, being what I call a vicious, how can I say it, attack round for the truth, is what I want to know is, okay, obviously they are either friendly or they're malevolent. And also they could be
clinically neutral.
Right, they could be clinically neutral, but they may have other agendas.
Of course.
That are completely different or even from a different cultural background that we can't even conceive because we don't understand how their thought process is because obviously they're not human.
That's right.
And so, or maybe they are. In fact, one of the things that's very obvious from my background in genetics is that there's 23 genes that are present in humans that are not present in any other primate. So it's very probable, in fact, that we didn't even originate on this planet.
Hey, why not a colony?
Right, and in other words,
hey, maybe it's the devil's island of this corner of the galaxy. They dumped all their bad boys and girls here, and that's why we're so nasty to each other.
Exactly, and the thing is, maybe we've got distant cousins that are on other star systems, and it's very probable. If you look at the genetics of human beings, a lot of the theories they've thrown together, like the theory of evolution and everything, doesn't all make sense. There's these huge jumps. There's all of these things where there's no intermediate species. And, of course, the people that are involved with their ideas, saying, oh, the Earth is only 6,000 or 7,000 years old. I say, that's ridiculous.
Bishop Butcher.
First off, I happen to be a believer, but my God's very big. He's a God of a universe that can have billions of civilizations.
Yep.
And billions of stars. And he's incomprehensible. If you understand the true, you know, I happen to be, if you want to call it, a Torah-believing believer, okay? He's incomprehensible because he's so beyond anything that we can conceive. That's why when he even spoke to Moses, he says, I am who I am. You know? I'm the God of a universe. A universe is a very big place. And
we're a
that,
primitive society whose major right. activity is tribal warfare. That's not
right.
saying much, is it?
Yeah, and the thing is that we're right at reaching what I call the nexus. We're actually at a point where we're about to have a vertical increase in technology. And if we don't rise to a higher level of desire for the truth and spirituality, which rules over the intellect, and that's why we're being blinded. It's the same reason why the scientists that were opposing Galileo when he showed clear evidence that the Earth was not a Copernican world, that we weren't rotating around the Earth, you know, everything wasn't rotating around the Earth, that man is not egocentric, the only and highest sentient cognitive being in the universe.
You're sure of that now?
Yeah, well, I'm certain. And the thing is, just look at the probabilities. And, you know, like Carl Sagan said to this, you know, billions and billions of stars. Well, just think of this our own local galaxy among hundreds of billions of galaxies, and yet we hear the foolishness that somehow we think we're alone. And it says it right in the Bible. It says in the other books, all the ancient books, that, you know, we've had ongoing contact with other civilizations and other beings of other worlds. And that's even the basis, if you want to call it, for the center point of all our religions. And yet we'll hear these so-called fundamentalists come up with these foolish things, and not understanding these things, they'll say they're all demons. We'll say, well, how about there's some that are incredibly malevolent and have really bad intentions and are willing to do things like trading and doing treaties? Just posit that. And how about there's others that have a civilization that, let's say, is in balance and has some form of order, and they're wondering whether we're going to make it or not. Because we're about to have, you know, we're on the edge of having maybe biological, chemical, or nuclear wars. I'm sure we're an object of great study right now because this civilization is near the point where we're either going to become a member of the cosmic civilizations of this universe, or we're going to expire like a little spark going out.
I think one of the reasons they're coming here, after going through 25 different reasons, you know, gas, food, lodging, next exit, et cetera.
Right. Good course.
I think one of the reasons they're coming here is to quarantine us. And I've asked this question of a lot of people. If you were an alien, would you want Earthlings out there? In other words, I make one assumption about every advanced civilization. It's concerned about its own survival and security.
Right.
That seems to be everywhere. That being the case, you have to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close tabs on those primitives who show signs of being able to bother you.
Well,
at the end of World War II, you realize aliens in the neighborhood got three signs that soon these idiot Earthlings would be moving out.
They're moving out at the speed of light, and their technologies are exploding vertically, which means we're leaping forward hundreds of thousands of years in technology, possibly with the aid of other civilizations that don't have very good intentions. And
but not with our sociology.
Pardon me?
We're not moving ahead with our sociology.
Right. We're, in fact, becoming more primitive. In fact, if you look at the way that America is being ruled now by this crazy junta that's running America with George Bush and his reign of terror, we actually have a civilization that's actually regressing and becoming more brutal. And do you want to have these kind of creatures jumping off world at warp speed with advanced weapons that can create black holes of stars?
I don't think so. I think they want to quarantine us. And let me give the three signs that made it clear. One was nuclear weapons.
Right.
Two was V2 rockets, which were not delivering mail from Germany to England, you may have noticed.
Right.
And three was advanced electronics, as manifested first by radar signals, which were the forerunner of a whole bunch of other things. Isn't it amazing that the only place on planet Earth in July 1947 where you could study all three of these at the same time was southeastern New Mexico? First nuclear weapon at Trinity Site, White Sands Missile Range.
Right.
That's where we were firing the captured German V-2s.
Right.
Some of which didn't go where they were supposed to go, many of them. And that's where we had our best radar to track these rockets. And I had a Russian, I mean, an English astronomer when I was over there for a television program said, well, they could have gone to the Soviet Union. Sorry, they didn't test their first nuclear weapon until August 1949, 2 years later.
Well, you know, I've got evidence from someone who came on my show. His name is Ragsdale. And they actually were doing tests with the Germans and Japanese back before the Second World War and exploded a very serious, very dirty bomb down at Bikini Atoll before the World War II. And so, and this is right from people that work right inside these projects. So a lot of occult science is going on. A lot of technologies are being transferred. The Germans were very advanced, and they had stuff.
Yes, they were.
They were doing saucer technology research that could transfer to the Skunk Works here. And believe me, this is not just American advanced spacecraft. If they think this is just a advanced American or European spacecraft, no. Yes, there's a lot of technology. I happen to know one of the senior NSA people who was right there in Roswell when everything happened. I personally, this is one of my contacts, and gave me incredible number of hours of all kinds of details that I've corroborated from many other sources. And the transfer of technology is awesome, and it's being trickled down. So one of the things he told me, for example, without giving his name out, because he hadn't given me permission to do that, is he told me about the he was an encryption tech specialist, and he was a senior NSA person when they actually started the National Security Agency, which in his words, quote, literally was born the day the Roswell thing happened. And what he said was he was working on a optic logic, non-electrical supercomputer that was a laptop in 1962 as a crypto a communication specialist. And he explained in great detail, because I have some advanced technical training of how it was using and/or not circuits, using micro lasers and these special laminar flow, sort of laminar type of micro circuits that were not electrical, but were using micro lasers. And so I was flying back 2 years ago with a senior person from Sony, and I said, well, what's the latest thing? We're in first class. And he said, well, the latest thing is we now are talking, you know, with building these light optic supercomputers. I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah, we're going to be coming out with even, you know, regular computers and even laptops in probably 5 or 10 years. I said, well, I know one of these guys that worked at the NSA, and he had one of them in 1962. So I started proceeding in the next hour and 15 minutes explaining in great detail the circuit design, how they made them and everything. He says, you can't know that stuff. That's incredibly classified. I said, look, they just trickled this down to you. This technology was there 40 years ago.
Hey, we got to give it to the military first, because that's what matters.
Right. Just like, for example, Atmel Corporation makes ferromagnetic chips that are EMP-proof, so you can't blast them out of the sky with an EMP weapon.
Yeah,
and
which is kind of neat.
Right. So all your enemies fall out of the sky because you just go beep, and that's it. No circuits work anymore, and they fall out of the sky.
Gee, wouldn't that be nice to have?
Right.
But, of course, we got to have enemies for that to be meaningful, so we got to manufacture them even if they aren't pushing us.
Well, you see, this is the whole military-industrial complex, which I think is one of the main barriers. And the problem is, you see, we've actually created a scenario that increases the likelihood of damage and danger. Just like people think, well, if we had, you know, a trackable ID in everybody and we had our DNA and a retinal scan, that increases the chances of identity theft. Just like increasing,
because the smart guys find out how to handle it.
Right. So the whole point is, what we need is a dialogue of honesty rather than these lies. If there are creatures, first off, we need to have a policy to find out what is going on. For example, one of the things that's very significant that I know from many, many sources is that these abductions really are real.
Yeah.
They're real. They're really bad, and they're really, really. And the other thing we have to see is that some of these abductions have some marks that make it look very occult, if you want to call it. They tie directly in with Luciferian cults, with things that are very nasty. Now, if you look back through ancient history, it could well be that, in fact, these things are very, very ancient, and that an ongoing relationship or dance with the, I call it the supraculture that's run our civilization from time immemorial, is a fixture that's always been there. It's not just a recent occurrence since the Second World War that all of a sudden these things are showing up. They were in the ancient Saudi Arabia. They were in India 10,000, probably 25, 100,000 years ago. And I'm certain that they had effects on civilization. And there were transfers of technology. There were probably things like even hybridization programs going on. There were all kinds of things that happened that are evidenced in all the ancient books of all the civilizations, from the Upanishads to the ancient Bible to the Epic of Gilgamesh to the Tales of Enoch to Genesis 6. All of these indicate that there were things happening that indicate some hybridization between what was here in the first place, man, and these other higher beings, and they became the rulers over these ancient civilizations.
You mean the giants who knew the men, women of Earth,
yeah.
For example?
And all those things. And I don't think these stories have happened so many times, and there's so much evidence that there are were, if you want to call it, Superman in ancient civilizations. Look at the at some of the ancient structures built in Baalbek.
Baalbek is one that I've talked to somebody who was there, and he said, Stan, you know, I've been to a lot of places, seen a lot of things, and he had. He says, how did they do that?
Look, the technology isn't even present now. We don't even have anything in our near future in the next 100 years to move stones like that.
Yeah. So we like to think of ourselves at the top of the mountain, and yet I tell people, I say, you know, you look around at the planet and you say, something's wrong here. We got 30,000 or more children dying every single day of preventable disease or starvation.
Right.
And yet our military budget for the planet is roughly $1 trillion a year.
Right.
There's something wrong with that picture.
Well, my project that I worked on back in 1973, I was just, whether it's a fluke or successful, I have a talent of research. I took a bacteria, managed to superculture it, create a radioisotope form of Chondrus crispus seaweed. I could grow 1 pound into 100 pounds of seaweed in 1 week with more protein than any other plant on the planet, put this bacterial digest enzyme and convert it to food to animals, and make more food than any other source in the world. And I discovered that and was able to complete the project in 5 months without any other federal government grants.
So why aren't we doing it?
Why aren't we doing it? Exactly. You know why? Because the university buried it and they didn't want me to continue with the project. I want to resurrect it because that was actually 33 years ago I succeeded in doing that. So I could take a pound of seaweed, convert it to 100 pounds, which has more protein and minerals than any other plant on the planet, digest it so the polysaccharides would be digestible by, say, feed animals like cattle and sheep and so on. And why don't we do that? Just the same way, for example, people say, well, all the fish are dying in the ocean. There's a Professor Isley, as a PhD physicist, that owns Vitamin Cottages, and he's a pretty well-respected scientist as well in Colorado. And he calculated that we just need 100,000 tons of iron sulfate distributed by planes to the major oceans in the top 10 meters, and you would have a bloom of phytoplankton that would bring back all of the chain of life right down to, you know, the
a lot of food.
Fish. Right. Very simple. Why do we have shipping lanes across the great whales' transportation routes so it's killing all the great whales? We need to realign our shipping routes so it does not interfere with these animals and kill them.
Among all the many other things we need to realign. But
right.
Let me give my website again before we
get
cut off.
Absolutely.
It's www.stantonfriedman.com, and a post office box 958 Houlton, Houlton, Maine, ME, 04730-0958. Send a self-addressed stamped envelope. I'll send you all kinds of free information, or go to the website and get a lot of challenges.
Yeah, we'll post some links, too, up on BBS Radio.
Okay.
We'll have to have you back on, Stan, because there's many more issues. And I want people to start thinking about this, because the reason why my show is called Clay and Iron is because I came to the conclusion after much study and being very sober about this, that unless you understand these issues, you will never, ever connect the dots of what's going on in world geopolitics, the military-industrial complex, the philosophies behind the, quote, people that rule the world, the Illuminati, whatever you want to call them. The fact that there have been ongoing things for untold millennia, that our civilization's been impinged by both probably positive and negative influences that are very evil, some of them that have been, if you want to call it, mythologized until the point where they don't make sense anymore and people then make conclusions that aren't logical.
Right.
And I don't have any misgivings that some of the things going on are extremely evil and some are probably very concerned, because would you want to contain a creature like us that, if we continued with our philosophy, spread off the planet with super advanced technologies spreading across the galaxy like a disease?
That's what we don't need.
Right. And if you were a galactic federation, let's say of 10,000 civilizations, some of them as old as maybe a billion years old, some of these civilizations transferring technology to us probably are really bad guys. And they transfer technologies to us, and all of a sudden we become, how can I say it, the latest wild man on the block with the with the biggest, baddest weapons you can imagine.
Right.
That can turn a star system into a black hole. That's not funny.
No, not at all. And we'll do it again.
Exactly. And obviously, the destruction not only that's happened on this planet, but I'm willing to bet that the destruction within the galaxy and galaxies across this universe have happened. And this is not the catastrophism of civilization is probably the norm rather than the exception.
Sad comment. But yeah. You're right. All right. We'll do it again.
Absolutely. Thank you, Stanton. It was an excellent discussion. I'm glad that you did it the same way I would say that Charlie Sheen did. You opened the can of worms. Now they have to look at it.
Okay. Thanks much.
Thanks very much, everyone. And we're going to have plenty of new guests. Do check out BBS Radio, and we'll be announcing them. And we'll have you back on the show, Stanton.
Okay. Thanks.
Take care, everyone, and take action, and check it out yourself.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a service.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.